How many Spotify followers have we got?
Oh, you're not going to make us guess. We're going
to
be talking
about. I started listening to the podcast the other day, and I was like, I don't like this guessing. I've changed it. I've made an executive decision.
21,000.
21,219.
Exactly.
Hell yeah.
Damn. Well done, Luke. Good job.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I don't have anything else to say. It's just a number, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a good number.
That is a big number.
Well, it's a bad number if it's number of deaths in my house today.
I think that's actually a pretty good number, because your house would then be famous.
It's an impressive number for a house.
You can't even fit 21 people in your house.
Might even be a world record.
He lives in a very, very...
Thanks, Corey. Just bought that house.
Well, yeah, I mean, and now 21,000 people have died in it, which is really going to decrease that market value. So the question for you all is today, would you edit your genes if you could? Get down to the YouTube comment and answer that question. Even if you're listening on Apple or on Spotify or wherever you listen, go to YouTube and answer the question in the comments.
I do. Sometimes I rip them. Sometimes I like fray the edges.
You could
bleach your jeans if you
please,
want.
Please, for the love of God, start the show.
Start the show.
Sorry.
Hello and welcome to the Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Cutford.
Adios.
Howdy.
Sorry, hello, welcome. I mean.
This week we're talking about crispy jeans and seeing things.
CRISPR.
Crispy.
CRISPR? Yes, CRISPR. Yes, CRISPR.
Not deep fried jeans.
No.
And
no.
Seeing things.
Things. I said that so it rhymed.
Okay, yeah. Right.
Seeing things. Seeing things, yeah. So what do you think this episode might be about?
CRISPR.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Cas9.
Oh.
There are two parts. I'll just start. Okay, so why don't we do a little recap on CRISPR? What is CRISPR?
It's a natural function of cells that we have sort of used to do a thing we want it to do.
Not all cells, though. Bacteria have this little thing called the CRISPR-Cas9 complex. CRISPR standing for...
Cool, really ingenious, hold on,
let me do that again.
Sexy,
no.
Pyrotechnic robot.
It stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. So CRISPR is basically something in bacterial cells that they use to cut bacteriophages, which are kind of viruses that infect bacteria. So this is something that we've taken and we've said, CRISPR finds specific parts of a genome and then it just does a little chippy chop, little slice and dice. And the idea is that essentially in bacteria, when they're being infected by a bacteriophage, basically a virus for bacteria, it'll chop up the genome of the bacteriophage, and the bacteriophage won't be able to do anything. It'll be like, oh no, my genome has been chopped up. I am useless, right? And so we saw that, and we were like, maybe we could use this to chop things that we want to chop. So what you do is basically...
It's a knife!
Yeah, well, it's a genetic knife, but it's a genetic knife that is very specific to specific sequences. So what you could do is program it and say, okay, this sequence, you chop here and you chop there. And that's very useful for us because why do you think that's useful?
If you want to chop.
Stuff you don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, gene editing, really. Mm. You could say, this is, you don't want it, chop it.
Yeah. We do know that bit, by the way. We're just playing with you.
It's like with me editing. If I don't want a bit in the video, I just go chop.
And then you shout CRISPR and loudly.
Chop, and then I go, this is basically CRISPR. Delete it.
Imagine if you were video editing. Instead of having to look, you know, what you could do is just have something that's set up to automatically chop around specific parts. You know, for example, if we were to do this, sorry, this is confusing for you, Jamp, but if we were to do this, if you had a little CRISPR editing thing, whenever it saw this, it'd be like, aha, chop. And it chopped.
I have a thing that chops every time I cut the camera.
So that's what CRISPR is. It's this little thing that we've taken from bacteria that chops up DNA specifically at specific points. Right, it can find a part of a gene or a genome and be like, "Boop, I'm going to chop here," which is fantastic, very useful. And we'll get more to that in a second. We've got a whole episode on CRISPR. Do you remember what episode it was, Champ?
No.
That's fine. I didn't check either. So
no.
Go looking through all the episodes, and you'll maybe land on it. I want to tell you a little bit about labor congenital amaurosis. Have you heard of that before?
No,
I would not have expected you to, because I had not heard of it either. It's a congenital eye disease that mostly affects your retinas. Do you guys know what the retina is?
Yes.
What is the retina?
It's the back of the eye that picks up the light.
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And only affects people who work as well. I mean, it's labor congenital.
L-E-B-E-R.
Oh, okay.
Very good.
Only people who work for the Labour Party.
The Labour Party, yeah.
That's really interesting.
Tories are safe.
L-E-B-E-R, congenital amaurosis. So it's this congenital eye disease that affects your retina. Congenital meaning that it's a sort of genetic thing. Now, essentially, there's a lot of different things that come along with this. Your retinas are not, they don't deal with light normally. So you can have quite severe visual impairment. People that have this are their eyesight degrades from infancy, and they're usually legally blind. They can also have photophobia, which is not a fear of light. It is not a fear of light.
It's a fear of photos.
No.
It only makes sense.
It is an abnormal reaction to light. So their eyes have an abnormal reaction to light, and their eyes have involuntary movements. They can have extreme farsightedness. They can also have an oddly shaped cornea. Apparently, they also can rub their eyes a lot. I think this is probably usually in infants, but they rub their eyes a lot. You know, with their knuckles, with their hands, which is called Frankenschetti's oculodigital sign.
That's fine.
Just rubbing your eyes is called
poking, pressing, and rubbing the eyes with a knuckle or finger.
I do that sometimes.
Yeah, but
I'm Frankenstein.
You do not have LCA.
No, I don't.
No, don't. So there are different subtypes. The subtypes are caused by different mutations from different genes, and a lot of these are caused by a point mutation on a gene. And a point mutation. Do you know? Have any guess what a point mutation might be?
Mutation of one letter?
Yeah, basically like a single point.
Single point,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, they can have different patterns of vision loss, different eye abnormalities. And the treatment, generally, for all of these sort of things, is trying to correct the farsightedness and using sort of vision aids where possible. But that's obviously not always possible. These people are generally sort of legally blind.
As opposed to legally blonde.
Illegally blind.
That too.
It's illegal. Get him. So
criminally blind.
The symptoms we've kind of gone through, but what I want to talk about a little more is kind of the percentage of people that have these symptoms, just so you get an idea. So 80 to 99% of people have abnormal sort of pigmentation in their retinas.
How many percentage?
80 to 99.
Of people who have this disease.
Yeah, of this disease.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Not of all people. if 80 to 99% of people had abnormal retinal pigmentation, it would not be abnormal.
Yeah, it'd be quite normal.
The 1% would be freaks. You got one color in your eye? Ugh, weird.
They have, this is still 80 to 99% of people with LCA. Can have abnormal optic discs, severely reduced visual acuity, and marked vision impairment. And 30 to 79% of people with this disorder can have an abnormality of neuronal migration and an abnormal electroretinogram. Basically, the tests used to look at your retinas and stuff, they can show up abnormal.
What is neuronal migration?
The move of neurons.
Really?
I have no idea. Okay. This is not... Well, sometimes when I say
things... You can tell me anything.
Sometimes when I say things on the podcast, I'm not... I don't go digging deeply into what these things are.
Yeah.
Sometimes if there's just a list of symptoms, I'll be like, okay, this is a list of symptoms. Because we're just scooting through this, I'll hop on. But Luke is great because Luke wants to know... What everything
I do. Well, I just because what it sounds like, neuronal migration, like the movement of neurons around the brain. It's like, I didn't know neurons could move. I thought they had fixed positions, or at least fixed positions relative to each other. So that's really interesting if that's the case.
I think neuronal migration, it is a fundamental process in central nervous system development. The assembly of functioning neuronal circuits relies on neural migration occurring in the appropriate spatiotemporal pattern. Basically, if your neuronal migration, that's a hard thing to say, doesn't work properly, you could have a neurological disorder. So it's basically how the sort of central nervous system develops.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
An abnormality of the development of the central nervous system, resulting in some kind of neurological condition.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
No worries. So what causes Leber congenital amaurosis? Now, it's mutations in at least, basically a mutation in at least 14 genes that we know of so far. It doesn't need to be all 14. There's just 14 genes that can cause this disorder due to a mutation. All of them are necessary for normal vision, and they all do different things in the retina. But like, you know, some of them are, some of them sort of cause the development of photosensitive cells, like the photoreceptors in your retina. Other ones are important for phototransduction, which is when the light that comes into your eye is turned into electrical signals that your brain can understand. There's basically lots of different things that happen on your retina these sort of genes can be sort of responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a mutation in any of those genes can could be associated with LCA. Now, there are, I'm going to rattle off some gene names for you. They're going to come up later, but you don't need to remember exactly what they are. So it's mutations in CEP290, CRB1, GUCY2D, and RPE65 are the most common causes of the disorder. And there's other, obviously, as I said, like there's 14 of them that we know of. But the other ones account for like a much smaller sort of proportion of sort of cases. And in about 30% of all people with this disorder, the actual sort of cause is unknown.
What?
Yeah.
So they don't have any of those gene mutations?
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, we don't know. That's why we say at least 14.
Wow.
Yeah. And it can be inherited. So it's usually autosomal recessive. Do you guys know what that might mean?
So you have to have two copies of the same gene from both of your parents in order to get it.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so that makes it less likely, which is nice. Which means that if you have it, you don't necessarily pass it on to your child as well.
No,
which
exactly.
Is it doesn't. So nice.
Yeah. But that means that if you've got two parents that are carriers, they can pass it on to their kid without knowing about it. And you know, it's very rare as well. It's a very rare disease.
Yeah, true.
You know, some of them, there is one, what is it? There is one of the genes that is... it is a dominant thing. It is autosomal dominant. I think that is CRX or IMPDH1 genes. If you've got a mutation on those, that is a dominant. So you will that is dominant characteristic. So you'll pass that on if you have two copies of it. So your kids will definitely have it. But if you've only got sort of one copy of it, then your kids might not have it. There's like a 50-50 chance.
50-50.
Yeah, exactly. So the most common mutation causing this sort of causing LCA is IVS26, which is changes an A to a G. Obviously on one of those genes, and it's basically it's a mutation that results in the sort of non-functionality of the CEP290 protein.
Exactly.
Of course. Right.
This is all. Like, you don't need to remember exactly what these gene names and whatnot are. Okay. But just know that they're different things, right?
Quick, my quiz is coming up. I'm remembering. As hard as I
maybe,
can.
Maybe. So that is LCA. That's Leber congenital amaurosis. Basically, it's an eye disorder that results from mutations in certain genes in your retina, and it can in quite a number of cases be caused by a single mutation. Like one of the most common ones is caused by a single mutation of a single base pair in a single gene, right? Which just goes through how important some of the proteins in your eyes are that in your retinas are that like one change can cause such a sort of massive loss of like visual ability. And in fact, I think this is the case of like essentially what happens there is this A changing to a G basically says stop, right? So it changes the sort of sequence from, you know, like I'll put this amino acid, that amino acid, that amino acid, that amino acid, then keep on going. It goes this amino acid, that amino acid, that amino acid, stop. So that basically the sort of protein is finished early and it's not the full protein.
Right.
All of that, bear that in mind. Okay. We're going to be moving on to something else. We're going to talk about AAVs super briefly. Adeno-associated viruses, which are essentially things that we use for gene therapy. They're little viruses, very little viruses, that can just go into you, do a little bit of gene therapy, right?
And what do you mean by gene therapy?
So gene therapy is basically altering your genes in a therapeutic sense.
So this is a different thing to CRISPR-Cas9 that can do.
It's not a different. This is a way of getting into sort of cells, right? So you use it as a sort of vector, which means basically you whatever sort of gene therapy you want to do, you basically put it in. You can put it into this virus, and the virus will take it into the cells that you want to put it into. And the way that this works, because obviously viruses, what they do is they use your cells sort of apparatus to make stuff, to make their own sort of genetic code. So what you could do is, it's the same, it's quite similar to the mRNA virus, the mRNA vaccines that we've got right now, wherein these mRNA vaccines, you sort of basically put mRNA into a cell, mm-hmm. and the cell starts to make this thing. So in the case of the mRNA vaccines for COVID, what they do is the mRNA, it is used in your cell to make the spike protein. So your body's like, oh, I've got a COVID spike protein. Cool. Great. Now I know how to defend against this, right?
Yeah.
So in this case, these viruses go in and they basically, you can make them to do whatever you want. And so we use them essentially for in vivo gene therapy. In vivo meaning sort of in the body rather than in vitro, which mm-hmm. would be in a sort of test tube or in a sort of petri dish or whatever, right? So a lot of the sort of the gene therapy that we've done up until this point has been, you take cells out of the body, you mess with them in the lab, you change their genes, and you put them back into the body.
Yeah.
Right? So what I want to talk to you about today is something that is slightly different to this, specifically about this eye disease, in that for the first time ever, we have used CRISPR inside someone's body. We have used it to actually edit genes inside a person's body.
Is this recent?
Therapeutically. In the past couple of years. So the clinical trial, I think, started in 2018, I think. Mm-hmm. It was first submitted in 2018. And it was kind of started, I think, in 2019. And it's running until 2024. So this is super recent. Like the actual results of this clinical study haven't actually come out yet. Mm. They did some sort of they presented preliminary results at a sort of conference, and it's kind of been out in the media, but there is not like a sort of paper to look at from this yet because it's still in progress. But we'll get to that in a second. So essentially what has happened before, like the only FDA approved treatment for LCA is Luxturna, which is a viral gene therapy that uses AAV, like adeno-associated virus, which we just spoke about, to correct a gene in your cells. But what it does is it basically inserts a new gene. So you've got a faulty gene. And what it does is it says, here's a new one. And so you've got both genes running. So you're still producing that like protein that doesn't work. You're just also producing the protein that does work at the same time.
Right.
And this is like the only treatment for this disease. But can you maybe figure out, like, with all these mutations, why this sort of treatment might not be the best?
Because you're still producing the faulty one.
Well, you're still producing the faulty one. But the fact is that because there are like 14 different genes that this can affect, this only helps with one of those sort of causes. So it doesn't cure all. It doesn't can't use it to treat anyone with LCA. You can only use it to treat people with LCA that have this one
very specific type. Yeah.
And the issue is that the reason I spoke about AEVs, adeno associated viruses, is because they're very small, and the limit to the amount of sort of genes that you can sort of, the limit to the sort of base pairs or sort of nucleotides, the size of the genes that you sort of use with them, it's limited, right? It's kind of small because they are small themselves. So you can't actually use just an AAV on its own to fix different genes that cause this disorder, right? So for example, the most common cause of this disorder, the number of nucleotides, the number of bases, the size of the gene that you would need to use is just far too big for an AAV. So what they've decided to do is use CRISPR to fix this instead. So what they've done is they've got this virus. They've taken their programmed CRISPR gene, I guess, and put it into this virus. So the virus then takes it into the body and lets CRISPR go loose. Does that make sense?
Somewhat.
Okay.
I'm struggling to follow the multiple layers here.
We've got AAVs, right? We've got these viruses that we use for some gene therapy.
And they sort of smuggle things into the body.
Exactly.
Into the cells.
Exactly.
Are they able to smuggle CRISPR into the cells?
Yeah, that's what they're doing with it.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
We've never done that before.
Right.
And this is the first time that we've done this. We've basically put CRISPR into a cell. Inside someone's body whilst they're still alive and kicking.
And we had done that before, but we'd only done it in vitro.
We'd put CRISPR into cells before, but yeah, only in vitro.
In a petri dish.
Yeah.
And so you've got this virus that it basically acts as the way of getting CRISPR into the body, into the cells, and then lets CRISPR out, and then CRISPR can then do the actual gene snipping and gene editing.
Exactly. And the thing with this...
And that's the only thing that virus does, sorry. The only thing that virus does for us
is just
smuggles things in.
Just put things in, yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And what CRISPR is doing in this case is what's really interesting is often what we do with CRISPR is we use it to make a chop and then add something else in. But because this one point mutation is essentially... It's a point mutation. It's this one single thing. What we can do is we can just chop out the faulty gene.
The single letter.
Yeah, we can basically chop that out. And then it just starts working again. So you don't have that. You don't have the faulty protein being produced. You just basically chopped out the bit that causes the problem, and the cells can then produce the proteins that they need to.
And you don't have to replace it with the correct letter.
No, you don't need to. You don't need to replace anything in this case. No,
that's really interesting. Does that not then mean that the letter we want to be there, isn't actually doing anything?
Not necessarily. Genes are a little bit more complex than that. Okay. I won't get into it too deeply, but the fact is that you can essentially just make the chop.
Yeah,
and the gene will work properly, the way they've cut it, as opposed to having to add something in or have like the faulty gene still be there. You can just make this one change, and boom! Suddenly, the cells in the retina are able to produce this sort of this protein again.
And this has worked. And how many people has this worked?
So, not many people.
Sorry,
so far
we haven't done it in many people, yeah. Or most people it's unaffected.
No. We've not done it on many people yet. So I think there's 18 people in this trial, 18 patients in this trial. And I think so far I only know about, I think, six or so of them that have actually sort of gone through it. I've only got sort of data on, I think, maybe about six of them. And it has worked on, it's worked on a few of them. I'm not sure the exact numbers. I have it somewhere, but I can't see it.
Okay.
It didn't work on all of them is the thing. It worked on a good number of them, and at least two.
And all these 18 people, or at least these six people, they've all... So I'm assuming what you've said earlier is applies here, which is that this fix only works for people with the one specific gene mutation. It doesn't work on all 14.
Yeah, it doesn't work on all, but this one. So there were two different ones, right? So it was one that they used that added in a new gene, right? Yeah. And that worked for like one specific one. And this one also works for one specific one, but it just so happens that this one specific one is the most common one.
And I assume that all these people in this trial have that one specific
That one. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it hasn't worked on some of those people. That's so interesting.
Well, I mean, it's obviously quite complex, right? It sounds very simple, but what we're doing is we're injecting this into someone's retina. There are a lot of problems that could happen, you know, between the correct gene being there and the correct proteins being produced. For example, the retinal cells could have degraded to the point where there's not enough to give back any significant amount of sight. But it is really, really interesting. So essentially, what has happened kind of before this is that we've kind of used CRISPR to treat things. Well, not to necessarily treat things, but we've kind of used it like sort of therapeutically before. And as I've said, this has always been out of the body. So what's cool about this is that you can literally just, for the first time ever, inject something into someone's eye and they start getting vision back. And the reason that we couldn't do any of this before with retinas is because you can't really remove retinal cells and then put them back in.
Too delicate?
Yeah, probably something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly why, but probably something like that. Probably as well, for example, if it was blood cells, easy.
Because you just put them back in the blood.
Back in, right? You know, there's lots of like liver cells as well. You could take them out, put them back in. There's lots of different cells that you could take out and put back in. But
yeah,
retinal cells are really difficult to do that with. So let's just quickly go through sort of the trial and what's going on with the trial. It was first submitted October in 2018. And they're still working on it. They're planning to work on it until I think May of 2024. So we've not finished this trial yet. We do know, like, after 4 weeks of having injected this, basically this stuff into their eye, they're injecting it only into one eye, by the way. So they've got the test eye, because obviously if there's any dangers with it, like, this is being used to understand dosage and stuff as well. They basically injected it in one eye, and after 4 weeks, they'd be able to find out if there's any vision that's come back. And basically, once CRISPR got into those cells, it went in, it cut out the mutation that was causing the disease, and some people's sight started to come back in really interesting ways. I've got some stories here for you in a second. But before we get into that, I do need to say that, like, obviously this isn't like, oh, we have absolutely cured this. This is a trial. This is a clinical trial that hasn't even finished yet. Right. So they obviously need to be treated for longer, and to, like, you know, we need to see that it's safe, that there's not going to be any issues with it. So we need to continue looking at this for quite a while. And it says there it's far from curing patients in the trial. But the changes are significant enough that it's actually changed their daily lives. Right.
Wow.
Because if they've gone from not being able to see very much at all.
Yeah.
They're now able to like see more, like basically they've got more like cells in their eyes.
Even basic vision.
Exactly.
Would be really good.
Yeah. So the thing is as well, must be really frustrating about this is that they've got different, because I said they were working on doses, they've got different patients with different doses. So they've got some patients on lower doses and some patients on higher doses. And obviously this is changing, like, the difference of the doses.
Yeah, it's like the test with aspirin when they were like trying to work if aspirin works for reducing, was it aspirin? I think we're trying to work out if aspirin helps reduce heart attacks or something like that. And then basically the results were so overwhelming that they stopped the study and went, right, we need to give everyone aspirin because it works so well.
Exactly, yeah. but
also, that is, so just quickly to check, the different doses are in order to see the effective, what level is effective. It's not because the people are, for example, larger people or have different size eyes.
To see what's safe and what's effective.
Yeah.
So it's both of those. It's basically to figure out, did we give this? Are they going to get ill?
Yeah.
Are we going to do something wrong? Is it going to hurt them?
Good to
them?
Check that stuff.
It's probably maybe. Good to check it. Yeah. But I mean,
but yeah, not very nice if you're stuck on a dosage that doesn't work and you're like, I want to see something, please.
Yeah.
Can you just give me a bit more?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, I need to say as well, none of the people that have got this have achieved what it says there as normal vision. Like, they've not gotten sort of full vision back. They're still, I think they're still all legally blind, but they, as I've said, there's enough of a change there that they have impacted, like, their daily lives have been impacted. So I'll just tell you, I've got two of the people in the sort of trial spoke to NPR. So I've got the kind of interviews that they gave there. So one of them's called Carly Knight. She said that apparently she couldn't even, she works in a sort of call center. She couldn't get around the call center using a cane. She was bumping into cubicles and really scaring people that were sitting in them, she said. And since then, she's improved enough to make it out of doorways, get through hallways, see objects and even colors, which is insane. Imagine going from like having to use the sort of like the cane to help you sort of navigate your way around to being able to like
see color,
literally walk, like see color and walk through a door. She said her vision is much clearer and brighter since the treatment. And instead of having to reach around blindly for objects, she can just look for them, which I mean, again, we all take sight for granted. Like it's the dominant sense, or rather, we think of it as the dominant sense because we rely on it so much.
Yeah.
And because so much of our brain is dedicated to processing it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which is, I mean, again, why we rely on it so much, I suppose. Or which way is it, do you think?
Well, if so much of your brain is dedicated to processing it, then it has some kind of advantage. Otherwise, the cost would not outweigh the benefit would not outweigh the cost. So yeah, we're so reliant on it because it's very beneficial to us, but also because we've built a world that requires you to see. So like, it's a bit of both, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, and that's the thing though, we take it for granted. We don't think about maybe even that sort of limited, like just being able to see a doorway or see some color. How going from not being able to do that to being able to do that would be such a massive step up. Because I feel like for a lot of people listening to this, like they might be thinking, oh, but they haven't got their like full vision back. So what's the point?
Yeah.
What?
Well,
no.
That's not. I mean, that's not how eyes evolved.
No.
Eyes evolved because any sight is more helpful than no sight.
Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely. And she said this, an example here. She said she dropped a fork on her kitchen floor and she just leaned down to pick it up and didn't know where it was and just saw it on the floor.
That it's must very be cool. Like so surprising.
Which it's just very after. Cool.
She's like, hang on. What just happened?
This is a superpower.
It feels like when astronauts go to space and gravity
and
just...
they leave things.
Yeah, well, yeah. Gravity just isn't there anymore. And you're like, oh. Oh, I don't... Like, things will just not fall.
It's really funny that you say a superpower. I once watched a YouTube series by a blind guy talking about what it was like being blind. And he was saying that... he's like, the idea that you know someone is, like, walking towards you before they've made any sound... It's like, you guys have a superpower and you have no idea. And it's just like, yeah, if you imagine the things that sight allows you to do. Like, you know an object is there when it's not making a sound.
Mm.
Like, to somebody who has never had sight, that would be a really weird thing. Like, how they might not even be able to comprehend how you would even go about that, or what, like, let alone like imagining what sight would be like.
Mm. You can estimate the weight of an object based on how it's moving.
Yeah.
Right.
How quickly it slows down and stuff.
Right. Like, it's and like, obviously you can estimate that based on like the sound. Like, you can say, oh,
like if it's making low frequencies.
I know roughly how heavy this iPhone that I just dropped on the desk is, but like, you can also see that just by watching a thing move.
Yeah.
It's so, wow.
Yeah.
Sight is interesting, right? It's weird. Very. But I mean, it's not, I guess it's not just sight. It's the fact that the way that your brain processes it as well.
Yeah.
Right.
We talked about that in I don't know what order the episodes come out in, but the episode with Bilal Jalal, we talked about how the brain has like a good model of how physics works, like to the point where you can learn things in your sleep that require you to understand physics. Just so weird. So that's what you're saying there. It's like, you can observe an object and infer its possible weight from seeing it. Like, that's a strange thing that we just take for granted.
Yeah. And it's kind of what I mentioned that episode as well, wherein when it's why CGI, I think, is so difficult.
Yeah.
And also not just that. I mean, okay, so this was a while ago. I was playing a Mario game, like whether it was a knockoff or a port, I was playing it and Mario didn't move correctly.
Yeah.
The weight of Mario was wrong. And I knew that.
Yeah.
Mario didn't feel right. Which is just like the fact that somewhere in my brain is stored. This is how this fictional video game character moves and feels to the point where if it's even just the slightest bit off, it's like, you know, you remember when Flappy Bird was big and there were all the knockoff Flappy Bird games.
They didn't feel right. No,
they didn't have the same. They didn't fall at the same rate or anything. Exactly.
When Fall Guys came out on PS4, didn't feel right.
Really?
Yeah. I couldn't play it.
So weird. It's so weird how your brain just tunes into that.
The Bland ep is going to be the next one next week, I believe. So look forward to that. That's a little sneak peek.
Spoilers. My apologies.
Luke, you can see into the future now?
Yeah, man. I opened my third eye. Have you opened yours?
I'm trying. She's stubborn.
So Carlene Knight, she's 55. She lives in Portland, Oregon. She dyed her hair green, which was her favorite color.
I thought you were going to say she died.
No.
She died.
She dyed her hair green.
Her hair green. Okay, good.
Happy ending.
To celebrate, because she's able to see green now.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's nice. She said it's kind
of
fun to see.
She's also presumably able to see the color of her hair naturally. And she was like, nah.
Not for me.
Well, no, green is her favorite color. So she was like, I'll dye it green.
Green is her favorite color now.
I think she had some sight as a kid.
Okay, right.
Because it's degenerate. You lose it.
I see. Yeah. So that's so sad.
She remembered green. I like green.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or she saw it and she was like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, green. I remember that now.
I've also got Michael Calberer. Why are these such difficult names? Got Mike. So he was another person in the experiment. He can see color for the first time in years. And apparently about a month after he first got the injection, a red car drove past and he spotted it and he was like, wow, that's red.
That happened.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, imagine,
yeah, like,
imagine not seeing color for like a decade and then suddenly seeing a red car.
To everyone else, it's just like another thing to see.
I feel like these moments, I can't give you a specific example, but I feel like these moments are like, if you've ever had moments where like you notice something and then you realize that you just noticed a thing that you haven't noticed for a while, right? You don't notice it whilst you're observing it. You notice it just afterwards, and then you reflect back on, go, oh, wow, I treated that as a normal thing, but that's not a normal thing now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, right? Yeah. It's like when I quit my job after a while, and I was like, oh, I can just do what I want.
Yeah.
Cool. Sometimes I don't realize that. I'm like, nice.
That's cool.
That's really cool. But yeah, like the first time that you realize, like, oh, wait, I don't need to wake up at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
You know,
I still occasionally wake up and I'm like, oh, God, I've got to go to school. And I'm like, oh, I haven't felt that in so long. Wow, that was a whole horrible thing I had to deal with for most of my life.
Right?
Yeah.
Horrible. Why do they do that to kids?
Bitch. Yeah. I don't know if that was because of school being like a thing I didn't like because I didn't have a good time at school, or if it was a thing that's like just the idea of having to do something that you don't necessarily want to do.
Yeah.
Like, it's probably a bit of both.
You're being beheld to it against you.
Yeah, mind. Like compelled activity, yeah. And also not a nice experience, yeah, for other reasons.
So Michael Kelber, he went to his cousin's wedding. He was the one that saw the red car. So he went to his cousin's wedding and he said, "I could see the DJ's strobe lights change color and identify them to my cousins who were dancing with me. That was a very, very fun, joyous moment."
No.
I think, honestly, like reading these, it's just like, oh yeah. And like being a deceased stuff is really cool. We genuinely do take a lot of this for granted.
It's too much for granted.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, think about all the colors you're seeing right now.
The purple.
Yep.
The Psy guy's purple.
I think what's interesting to me is that I think that sight is really kind of overwhelming to an extent. It could be really, really overwhelming because it's not really something you can turn off.
Yeah.
Right? You can plug your ears and it's kind of, you know, you can not really hear very much, and that's fine. Yeah. But even when you close your eyes, you're still seeing things.
Yeah. The way I put this into perspective is, this might be a niche reference, but if you think about the size of an uncompressed audio file and then think about the size of an uncompressed video file. Now, you may have come across an uncompressed audio file in normal everyday life very occasionally, but you will never come in contact with an uncompressed video file,
no,
because they are monstrous. I had to submit my film as an uncompressed video file, and it was so big that it would take 2 days to upload over my internet, so I had to put it on a hard drive and drive it there because it's like 500, 600 gigabytes.
Oh, yeah.
Just one uncompressed film. So think about like an hour and a half of sight, right, which is my film, at like not even like a massive, like your eyes are probably higher resolution than this, is 600 gigabytes, which is 600, oh, I don't even know, like trillion bits of information for an hour and a half. Like, it's a ludicrous amount of information. So yes, of course it's overwhelming. It's so much data.
But the processing that you do on that data, when this is what baffles me constantly, that everything that's in my field of view right now, I can identify. And my brain is doing it. Like, it's kind of...
You don't have to try
filtering it out.
It's
just doing it automatically. Like, yeah. And whenever I think about this, it stresses me out because suddenly, instead of just like filtering out all of the things that I've identified, my brain is like saying, "Oh, those are sound panels. That's Luke. Those are headphones. That's Jamp. That's microphone. That's t-shirt." Stop. So don't want to know all of. I don't. It's so frustrating. Like right now, it's too much. Just try and doing that. Just
don't
try
do it right now. No.
Whatever you're doing right now, just look, and try and just tell yourself to just analyze everything. Just like think about what everything is called.
It's like when you accidentally trigger the screen reader on your iPhone and it reads out like a text to you or a tweet or something.
And it just doesn't end.
Oh God, it just goes on forever.
Or like when you realize that your tongue's too big for your mouth or that you can control your breathing, you know.
Why would you do that?
What? You got to control your own breathing and that your tongue doesn't fit comfortably in your mouth?
No, shut up about the tongue.
Your eyes are itchy.
No, they're not.
Yes, they are.
Manual blinking mode.
But your head?
Oh, my head is itchy.
Is your head itchy?
Mine isn't.
What if I say nits? No. Or head lice.
I just think of the smell of tea tree shampoo because that's how my mum used to wash nits when there was a knit outbreak at school.
Why would she wash the nits?
How many outbreaks?
Get them all individually and bathe them.
Tuck them into bed. Have a good night.
They're eggs. What are you washing them for?
Shiny.
So, he also saw a sunset. For the first time in ages, and apparently that was a great moment. So that's kind of a general overlook of this sort of therapy, which is really, really cool. Like, I cannot overstate to you how incredible it is that we've managed to get to a point right now where we are able to inject gene therapy into people's bodies using CRISPR. We've injected gene therapy into people's bodies before, as I said, using those AAVs, those adeno-associated viruses. But the issue with those is, as I said, that they're small, and you've got a limit on how large, basically, the thing that you... Sorry. But the issue with those, as I said, is that they're small. You've got a limit on how much information you can sort of change, right? Whereas with CRISPR, you can basically set it up to only cut at a certain point. It gives you a much, much bigger sort of range that you can sort of work with, right? Because basically what CRISPR does is it just finds a sequence and says, okay, I'm going to chop at this sequence, right? Which means that you wouldn't need to sort of put the whole sequence into the actual virus. You could just say, hey, CRISPR, chop at this bit, and it's roughly it doesn't take up that much sort of space in the virus. Do you know what I mean? Like, sort of data space, which is incredible. But I do want to talk about, before we sort of move on, are some potential issues with this. Do you think maybe some potential issues that might come up with putting just injecting CRISPR into someone's body?
This is something I've wondered actually since we first talked about CRISPR. Is there ever the risk that the sequence it's targeting occurs twice in the genome?
So yeah, off-target mutations, that's exactly what we're talking about there. Essentially, if you've got a sequence that shows up twice in the genome, CRISPR doesn't know, doesn't care. No. It's not like, oh, I know, it just chops that sequence. So chop, chop, chop. And what?
Like looking at the reference picture, like. Yeah. Yeah, you fit.
Yeah.
I'm taking you.
CRISPR's like a racist Sorry. Cop. If you're black, yeah. you're going in. But it doesn't.
Yeah, you look pretty similar. Close enough.
Well, I mean, what is the issue? Like, what might happen if you chop in the wrong place?
You mess up a different protein.
Exactly.
Make some other problem for yourself.
Exactly, yeah. And this could also end up causing cancers, potentially, as well. You know, if you think about it, you know, if you've got a gene that kind of protects you from getting cancer and you snip that, oh boy.
Oh, God.
Is she coming, right? You want to be careful with what you're doing. So what they've said, I've got a quote here. It says, rare off-target edits that are made to sequences that have no function or that disrupt an essential cellular function, causing a tiny fraction of cells to die, in my opinion, are not likely to be clinically significant. And that's from David Liu, a PhD, who is a biochemist at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard University. Essentially, what he's saying there is that, look, there are going to be some off-target mutations. That's basically unavoidable. But if they cause some cells to die and they don't really affect that much else, it's probably fine.
The greater good.
Yeah, exactly.
I assume I'm correct in assuming
no.
that... Oh.
Double assumption.
When you assume, you make an ass out of youm, and...
Okay, well, let's find out. I assume I'm correct in assuming that when you inject this virus carrying CRISPR in to, for example, the eyes, it stays in roughly the area you've injected it into. It doesn't go around the body.
As far as I'm aware, it's quite localized to the retina.
Sorry, as far as you're aware. So you're assuming.
Ooh.
You got me. You got me. Or I'm protecting my ass.
Yours is an educated assumption, whereas mine was just an assumption.
Yeah, as in I think I read that, but yeah. I don't want to go out on a limb and say it doesn't affect any other part of the body because it may seep a little bit, but it's
not like you know, you inject it like it's not like when you eat paracetamol, for example, that goes into quite a lot. Like you get paracetamol built up in other areas other than the pain, the place you're targeting the pain. A lot of your body gets pain killed, even the parts that aren't painful.
I'm not sure. So how paracetamol works is that it goes around, it basically goes through your, like, you eat it, it goes through into your sort of liver, bloodstream, and then it goes around your body. And if there are any of those sort of, I can't remember if it's the pain receptors or if it's the sort of chemicals that signal
it's the
pain.
The gap in the middle of, between the synapses.
But I think it only does that if they're sort of active.
Really?
I think it's their specific chemicals that are present when it's active. And that's what it binds to.
Oh, okay. So my paracetamol was a poor example then.
Yes, I think it was.
Okay. Yeah. Well, cool.
Yeah. I'm fairly sure that's how it works. Like, we can talk about it specifically at some other point, but I think it only targets receptors that are experiencing pain at that point.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Good job, paracetamol.
That's why you don't go completely numb.
Yeah. Right? Well, I assumed that it was just targeting pain as opposed to like other senses.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. So like, data. But like when you take paracetamol, right, it can protect you from pain.
Yeah.
But if I flick you in the face, you're still going to feel pain.
That's true.
So it only targets sort of the active pain receptor.
Sustained pain.
Well, yeah. So when you if you're in pain, so I assume that if you're pinching yourself, you know, about 30 minutes after you've had your paracetamol, which is when it starts to get into your bloodstream, that it might go there and be like, no, stopping you, pinch. I don't know, though. We'll have to, we could do a little experiment with Luke and some paracetamol.
So I pinch myself.
Pinch you.
Well, you have some paracetamol, and then after maybe about 20 to 30 minutes or so, we just pinch you.
Yeah.
We keep you being pinched.
Yeah.
And we'll see if it stops you.
Yeah.
From being at
peak. But then we also have to pinch me without paracetamol for a control, which is just cruel, really.
No, I think we should do that. I think that's fine.
They're more pinching them, aren't they? So if you're suggesting it, then yeah.
Also, we should do one where you take the paracetamol and after, like, you know, after the amount of time is gone. Okay, so here's
what
we start
pinching myself.
So here's what we do. Yeah, so here's what we do. We do one where you're pinching yourself from the moment that you take the paracetamol.
Yeah.
You do one where you're pinching yourself after the paracetamol would have just sort of entered your system.
Yeah.
And we do one where you take it And then after the paracetamol has entered your system, then a little while after that, you start pinching yourself. And then also where we just pinch you with no paracetamol.
Okay.
So four.
Four.
Mm, four pinches.
Okay. And all this time I'm taking a dose of paracetamol I don't need to take.
Well, you do need to take it if you're being pinched.
You're in pain, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I have, honestly, Luke, not a single clue.
And yeah, okay, right. Okay, well, I mean, I'm fine. I'm down for it. Yeah, it's weird. Can I take Calpol in one of them as well? Because that tastes so good.
It does taste good. Don't drink Calpol at home Calpol. Unless you're a sick little kid.
Or you're pinching yourself.
No, don't give them bad advice. YouTube will take us down for medical misinformation.
Not again.
Don't take Calpol unless you're in pain and you know how to take it.
And you're a child. And your parents giving it to you.
No, you can take Calpol if you're an adult, if you want.
You probably shouldn't, though.
Why not? It's just paracetamol and flavoring.
No, but it's for kiddies. You take up the Calpol, the kids aren't going to get it. Supply and demand.
But if the adults demand Calpol, Calpol will be made.
It'll be supplied.
But it will go up in price and the kids won't be able to get it.
The kids can't.
Calpolism. Anyway.
Price them out the market.
Calpolism. That's perfect.
What is driving this recent inflation boost? Well, Corey and Luke and all the other Sci Guys followers have been buying up all the Calpol.
Okay. So, yeah, these off-target edits are not, they're not like sort of desirable, but you can limit it, right? And obviously, if you're worried about the sort of off-target edits that contribute to cancer, what you could do is you could monitor those specific genes, the sort of cancer-associated genes, during the development of a therapy, right? So then you, if there's not really any change to them, then you know, okay, cool, we're not going to be hitting any off-target edits using this specific gene therapy because we've looked at these cancer genes and it doesn't even have a huge effect on them.
Out of interest, two questions, really. Firstly, surely you know there's going to be off-target edits because you can sequence the genome of the person you're putting it into first and you can tell if the area that you're targeting is repeated.
Yeah, but if you think about doing that for every single person that you're going to be giving, like, it's, yeah. I guess you could conceivably do that.
And the second question is there a limit to the length of the genetic code that CRISPR can target? Because obviously the longer the code, the less likely you're going to have a second, like a miss hit.
There is a limit, but I can't remember what that upward limit is. Mm. But ultimately, you think about how the sort of, you don't need that much to, you don't need to, it doesn't need to be that big to not have that many, not show up that often in a genome, yeah. Right? Because there's the different base pairs, but like, even with like four,
the statistical likeliness gets ridiculously high with only a few more. Yeah.
I mean, saying even with four base pairs, sort of like with sort of a sequence of four, you still got quite a lot of combinations just coming from that four. Then you think about eight, then 16. Mm. There's lots of different sequences, lots of different combinations. So yeah, exactly. And there's also some like future treatments that can be used with this technology. I mean, obviously this blindness study is just one, but apparently there's about 24 CRISPR-related clinical trials that have been launched around about the same time. I mean, they've been used to sort of try and treat blood disorders like sickle cell disease and something called beta thalassemia. There's also something called, I think it's Hunter's syndrome or Hunter's disease, I think that's something to do with, gosh, I can't remember, a specific protein or specific sort of sugar or something in the body. And they sort of tried to use CRISPR to treat that. It didn't work very well, but it was a good sort of, it showed that you could use CRISPR in that way. So it didn't have a huge therapeutic significance, but as a sort of proof of concept, it was fantastic. Apparently it'll be like quite a while before we see any CRISPR sort of therapies hitting the sort of like market, I guess. So you won't necessarily be getting this anytime soon, but it is on the horizon, which is really cool. This really specific gene therapy that you just get injected into you and your genes are like, you don't need to get them taken out and then like cultured in the lab, fixed in that way, and then put back in your body. You can just be injected with a little bit of like sort of gene editing stuff that can fix your, that can like alter your genome so that it doesn't have the mutation in it anymore.
Do you think we're ever going to get to the point where the hair dye industry comes up against alternative, which is that you can get your hair genes altered so that you grow different color hair?
No.
Why not?
Because both of those would work in tandem.
Well, okay.
Because it would take... Yeah. How long does it take for your hair to grow?
Well, yeah, a few months.
How long does it take to dye your hair?
Yeah, no, I understand that. But like if someone wants to permanently change their hair, like I might have permanently changed my hair when I was like 12 and getting beaten up for being ginger. I might have been like, yeah, go on, stick some CRISPR in my scalp and we'll get this over with.
Wow, that's so sad.
I'm not saying I should have done it. I'm just saying it might, like if I lived 200 years from now, maybe.
In that sense, yeah, I suppose people could potentially do that. I mean, they might take a hit, but I think that the sort of flexibility of hair dyeing would still keep it around. But yeah, no, that is an interesting point. I mean, contact lenses, you know, just,
yeah.
Although I don't think that would quite work the same way, but it is interesting that we could be looking at a future wherein, you know, you just edit people's genes.
Yeah. I just wonder, cause like the liberalization of so many things that once were not like accepted parts of society, when this becomes like super safe and sequencing everyone's genome is like takes like 5 minutes and it's a prick of your finger, which it already takes like 15 minutes to sequence a genome, doesn't it? And you can check for all the doubles, and then this is super simple: shave the head, inject it in a few places, done. Like that just seems like a totally alien thing to us, but like it would be a totally normal thing to them.
Yeah, I mean, if you want, you could probably. I mean, there might be something making you able to stimulate cell growth so that the protein is produced, like the protein strand, the keratin strand for your hair is produced more quickly than normal, which is super interesting. I don't know. It opens up all of these cool like sort of sci-fi ideas that are close to becoming sci-fi.
Yeah.
Sci-fact.
Yeah.
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 Non-sci-fi.
Sci-non-fi.
Yeah. Sci-non.
Yeah.
I hate that, again, we've spoken about this before. I hate that fiction is...
The default.
And non-fiction.
You're a nerd, Corey.
No, it just seems weird that like, what is this kind of book? Is it real or not real? No, is it like not real or is it not real? Doesn't make any sense.
No,
is it make believe or is it not make believe?
Exactly.
That's my point. Is because you're a nerd. It's not. Is it not real? Is this a story or a not story? Is it a creation or is it a not creation?
Yeah, but reality is reality.
Yeah.
Having the default be not reality, just plain silly, I think.
I think some people prefer that.
Well, clearly, of course you would think
that. When reading. I exclusively listen to factual books.
So. And I almost exclusively read nonfiction up until recently. So.
Yeah.
Wait, no, fiction up until recently. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, SciGuys has got you into reading.
Non-fiction. Never read a single book. I have read multiple books.
Hey, I've seen the accounts. You've read some books.
Yeah, I read some books.
Unless you bought the books and not read them. In which case, I'm going to be having a word with you.
No, I've read quite a number of books.
Have you? Sorry.
Yeah, and I actually read them instead of getting someone to read them to me. This episode is brought to you by Audible.
I wish. Hey, Audible, if you want to hit me up for a spot, I spend enough money with you.
So, I mean, you can also, I saw a study that was using it in cancer. Some of the patients died, but the idea is still there. Instead of, you know, using CRISPR instead of chemotherapy, just altering the genome of the...
Altering the cancerous genes.
Yes.
Could you alter the cancerous genes so they just die?
I mean, you could.
Yeah.
I mean, you could probably just... Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of cancer is that it grows without dying.
Yeah.
And doesn't like to stop.
So and cancer is mutated at some point, hasn't it? So if you can put in the mutation that cancer has and you just go CRISPR, chop it.
Yeah.
Just chop it up. Don't replace it with anything. Just chop it up.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it just
dies. I mean, that's the idea. Obviously, it's a little bit more complex than that. But
really?
The idea is still... A tiny is a little bit more complex. But the idea is still there. And it's really cool. This is like so interesting to me. I read so much on this because it's just so cool that we can just inject this thing that can just chop up your genes and sort them out if you want them to. And what's interesting about this, I think I kind of want to talk about the ethics of this at this point, because we've spoken about something similar to this before, and people are always worried about gene editing, particularly with sort of disabilities like sort of blindness, and you know, a lot of times this comes up with sort of deaf people saying, oh, we don't want to have our sort of genes changed because it's sort of XYZ. In this case, I think that it's not affecting the gametes, right? So I don't, as far as I'm aware, this is pretty much located just with your retina. So if you are like recessive in this, you could pass it on and still technically pass on that gene, you know?
Yeah.
So the worries of sort of this being a case of like, oh, this kind of eugenics or something like that, it's somewhat lessened in this case.
Yeah, we should really probably try and perfect it in people before we allow it into their gametes.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like in, because you can mess up an individual person as much as you like, and they can still have a baby that's not going to carry that messed up thing.
Well, I think what's interesting with this is that there's the element of choice there as well. So 3-year-olds and up, they did with this study. So they were doing it on kids, but the fact is that like there's still that element of choice there. You know, because a lot of issues that people say is, oh, well, you're editing the genomes of embryos, so they don't have the choice to whether they want to live like this or like that. And you're kind of saying that this like kind of mode of life is less valuable. In this case, though, the people, like, you know, the adults that volunteered for this trial, they're adults. They can make their own decisions. They want to edit their genes. They can, which is pretty fantastic, I think.
Sorry, could you just clarify what you mean by there's an element of choice when you've done this experiment in 3-year-olds?
There's an element of choice in that the person, like a 3-year-old is a person and can choose. And obviously, the 3-year-old... Listen. So the study, the sort of clinical trial, was with 3-year-olds. I'm not saying that it needs to be done with 3-year-olds, but like because it's not being done on embryos, people that aren't embryos generally can make a choice. Obviously, I'm not saying that they should do it on 3-year-olds, but of the adults in this study, they could choose. And so if this therapy was to sort of be perfected, then it could be something that could be given to people who make the choice to get it, rather than something that is given to an embryo. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't saying that 3-year-olds could choose.
No, this is why I asked you to clarify.
That's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Mammy, I've been reading up on CRISPR.
So I've also got a little bit about the accessibility of this. So this is just a quote from one of the people that sort of is working in this area, saying that we don't want it to be developing CRISPR treatments that benefit only European Caucasians. So the idea is that you want to make it generalized. You can make it sort of available to a lot of people without having to make it very specific to someone's specific genome, because a treatment which is similar to this treatment that we're looking at is sort of $400,000.
Come on, NHS, come on.
And also the genetic databases that scientists use to program these edits for CRISPR are based mostly on white people. Well, yeah. It's Caucasian populations.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
Obviously it's not. People are like, oh, science is racist. It's very racist. Not like on purpose, it's just people are racist, you know?
And they're not always racist on purpose either.
Oh.
But they still are racist.
Oh, the system is racist.
Yeah.
Mostly on purpose.
So much racism.
Well, you know how we can end it? Really, please, come on, we're running out of ideas here. Do you know how we can end it?
What if we...
Come on, Jem.
It's all on you.
Just like come together and we decide to not see color anymore.
I think you might have cracked it.
Use then, CRISPR to make everyone colorblind. Genius.
Oh, amazing.
I think that's it. I guess that's it. That's the episode. But what we got to do is a little quick fire quiz.
Bom, 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 bom. Crispy edition.
My question is first, what do I start off these quizzes with?
Asking what our buzzers are.
Well, no, the rules. Tell us the rules, please.
That was a quick fire quiz. Jamp, you won. Luke, you lost.
He actually didn't buzz, so.
Good job.
He's changing the rules.
Nah, here's the rules. So the rules are, one, I ask a question, one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer after I finish asking the question wins. What do they win, Jamp?
Nothing.
You gosh darn right. So Luke, what is your buzzer?
Crisp.
Jamp, what is your buzzer?
Oh, I'm going to discover that.
Okay, Crispoo. The topic of today's episode. So, my question for you today is, what does CRISPR stand for?
No bloody chance.
Oh, God. I just can't remember what the C stands for.
I can't remember what the C, the R, the I, the S, the P.
The P stands for palindromic.
Mm-hmm.
The R stands for repeating. No.
The first person to get any of the other letters wins this one.
Interspaced.
Okay, yeah, well done. It's clustered regularly interspaced.
Palindromic.
Palindromic repeats.
Yes, there we go.
I've forgotten it already.
It's okay. Now for another point of nothing. What does CRISPR stand for?
I've forgotten it.
Crispy.
Clustered.
Crispy. Clustered. Jamp. Regular.
Jamp.
Oh. Clustered. And then I've forgot something. Interspaced. Secular.
Good enough. Well done. You both get a point.
I don't think I deserve that.
No, neither do I.
Oh, dearie me. Well, why don't you head down to our comments and tell us who do you think deserved the win, Jamp or Luke?
Not me.
Well, pretty much neither of us, to be honest.
Before we go, we would like to thank all of our patrons and thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys. Or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can join the Discord and join the community. Why don't you send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at Noel Curry everywhere.
Follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
Goodbye. Clustered, regularly interspaced, palindromic repeats.
Woo!